Today's Taisho will be on Case 45 in the Bumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 45 is entitled Hoen's Who Is He? Hoen of Tosa said, "Even Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of another. I want to ask you, who is he?" Mumon's comment, "If you can really see this another with perfect clarity, it is like encountering your own father at a crossroads. Why should you ask whether you recognize him or not?" Mumon's verse, "Don't draw another's bow, don't ride another's horse, don't discuss another's faults, don't explore another's affairs." Today is the final day of our August 2012 session, and this is the 10th anniversary of our first coming here to do session. That means we've had something like 50 session here. That's a lot of wonderful awakening moments, a lot of people working through their barriers. Wonderful. Yesterday morning I was sitting and all of a sudden I could remember the voice of my teachers. My teachers used to give Taisho during Sesshin, and Genki Roshi would speak and Webb would translate. And I myself don't know any Japanese. A few people in our group know Japanese, but I didn't. But the Taishos were, really long involved affairs, because Genki Roshi would speak and then Webb would translate. I can remember, just sitting here, I could remember their voices. I could remember Genki's voice, and then I can remember Webb's voice. And Genki's voice was was deeper than Webb's, and very soft. He would speak very slowly and deliberately. There are these phrases that stick in my mind. He would say, "Shitori shitori wa." I have no idea what "shitori shitori wa" means, but he would sigh and say, "Shitori shitori wa." I could just hear him saying that. I could hear him saying that. And then I can hear Webb's voice, which is higher. It was so audible. It was just in my mind, those tapes were playing. And I thought of how much I loved both of those people, And the Taishos were really interesting for all kinds of reasons. One of the reasons was that sometimes Genki Roshi would say something that was really long. He'd go on and on, and then Webb would translate it. He likes that. Sometimes, it would be the other way around. He would say three things, and Webb would go on and on. Somebody who knew Japanese said Webb heavily edited Genki's Taisho, actually, because Genki actually was very salty and even coarse. And we never knew this about him. We had this ideal of him as this very, he was actually a very sweet man, but he had like a very salty, he might say something like, "That fathead," or something, and Webb would translate it as, apparently they didn't get along or something like that. One time, Genki was very, Genki Roshi was a war orphan, and he was raised in a monastery, which is not a healthy place for I mean, if you were a therapist, you would not think a monastery is a good place for a child to grow up in. Because he didn't have any other children, friends. And he was like a little monk, you know. He lived with the monks, and when he was like 12 years old, he was doing sesshin. So actually, that's not a good idea. That's really like a terrible idea. But, you know, basically they just tucked him away in this temple with really one of the most famous meditation masters in the 20th century, Yamamoto Genpo Roshi. And Genki Roshi said, you know, he would do sesshins at 11 years old, and he just hated it. And he said he used to sit there, his legs would hurt so much, and he'd just pray for an earthquake, you know. An earthquake would come and pull the temple down on his head and kill him. So he could escape, I guess. Another time, he said that in Zen temples, you know, Mary went to a Zen temple in France, in Paris, and she was surprised to see that they had a stick that they hit people with. This is a part of Japanese Zen, and it's called a teaching stick, a kyosaku or keisaku, and it's a flat. You know, in American high schools, they used to have something called the Board of Education that they would use to spank people with. And it was a like a paddle, like a cricket paddle, actually. And this is before the Supreme Court ruled, and I'm totally in favor of this, ruled that corporal punishment could not be administered in the school. But before then, if you were really, really bad, you could be sent to the principal, and he would make you bend over and hit you in the butt with a paddle. So in Zen temples, they have a long version of that, a stick. And it's made out of pine. It's a light wood. And they actually smack you on the back. You have to bend over in a certain way to protect your ribs and your spine. If you do that, there's a meaty part of your back. It's a big muscle in your back. And you expose that muscle, and then they hit you with the flat part of this stick. And it's not it's like a slap. But basically, in a Zen temple, in the morning, there's a person who holds that stick and goes up and down the aisles and patrols. And if you move a muscle, he's on top of you, right? So basically, when sitting starts, the person's called a jiki jitsu. He goes up and down, and he's just looking. You know, they usually pick some obnoxious person to do this job, you know. So, that you know, who's like a drill sergeant. The person's like a drill sergeant, goes up and down the aisles. And it just makes you tense just knowing he's looking, right? It's like, holy crap, you know, don't move a muscle, you know. And Mary was shocked to see this in Paris, and I myself think it's totally pointless, and it didn't actually exist in Chinese Zen, so we've gotten rid of it. But anyway, Yamamoto Genpo Roshi used to hit Genki Roshi with that stick when he was a bad boy, and Genki Roshi said one time he was so mad that he grabbed it and broke it in half and threw it down the well. Which is cute, right? Yeah. So anyway, Genki Roshi was a wonderful person, but he was a strange guy in certain ways too, because of his upbringing. And one of the things he had was a prejudice against other. He was part of this tradition called Rinzai Zen, Linji Zen. And basically, he believed that Linji Zen was the true Zen, and the other school, the Soto Zen, was like not very good Zen. And so he told this very famous story about, there's a famous story in Japan about a warrior who had to go fight Mongols were invading Japan. They had a huge fleet, and they were going to take over Japan. They were going to sail across the Strait of Japan and land in Japan and take over the country. Fortunately, a storm destroyed a lot of their fleet, and then the ones who did get to land were decimated by the Japanese samurai. But one, this very famous samurai was going, preparing for battle and expected to die. Nobody expected that the Mongols would be defeated. And he was meditating all night, and he was staring at a waterfall, and at one point the waterfall just stopped moving. It was like the water was just hanging in air. And so he had had like a Kensho experience, and this went on, the water was hanging there for a while, and he finally got up, and he didn't get killed in the battle. And he went afterwards to find a priest, a Zen priest, he could talk to about the experience. And when Genki told the story, he always said that this first, the samurai went to a Soto temple, but they don't know anything about enlightenment there. And they'd say, then he went to a Rinzai temple and talked to Hakuin Zenji, you know. So anyway, when Webb told the story, he would say, my friend who knows Japanese said, Webb said, he went to one temple, but no priest was there. And then he went to the next temple and found Hakuin Zenji, right? So this would annoy Genki too, and would censor his teishos and change the meaning. This caused the tension. But I can still hear them speaking, and it's interesting to me that it came through so audibly and so clear after all these years, you know, like 30 years. I can remember going to a sesshin, my first sesshin. Please forgive me, many people have heard this story, but I was living in Seattle, and in retrospect I realized I was depressed and I had an anxiety disorder. That's my clinical judgment now. But I started doing meditation because it helped me, it made me feel better. But I was doing it by myself. I'd read a few books about meditation. And I went to this Tibetan center in Seattle. And they had a beautiful Zen hall. The Tibetans have such lovely colors in their meditation hall. The cushions were red, were maroon, and the zafus had a maroon band around the side. And then the tops were gold. And there were all these beautiful gold and maroon banners hanging off the ceiling. It was a very beautiful place. And I would go in and meditate by myself. And one day, the door was just left unlocked. Anybody who wanted to go in and meditate could go in and meditate. It was a very nice place, you know. And I went in and meditated. But one day, somebody else actually showed up. And he said, you know, a Japanese Zen master is here, has just come to Seattle. So I went to a place that was like our university setting at the University of Washington. And that was where the Seattle Zen Center had its weekly Thursday night or Wednesday night sit. And I started doing that. I started going at night at 7 o'clock. And we would sit for three periods of meditation, and then I would go out with my friend, who also was going, Bill, and we would both have a big glass of beer, which would totally undo all the effects of the meditation, because it was always this giant glass of beer, and I would get up feeling very foggy in the morning. But I started sitting, and I liked it, it was okay. And I liked the group, it was okay. And about 3 weeks into the process, about three sits into the summer, this beautiful woman came up to me. She was a Japanese American woman. Her name was Wendy Nakao. And she said, would you like to go to sesshin? And she was the leader of the group at this time. And I didn't even know what sesshin is, but I just said, yes, I'd love to go. And I smiled at her. So anyway, I went to Sesshin. I had been training for 3 weeks. At least I sat three times. You know, and the Sesshin was full of people. We had like 25 or 30 people. All of them knew people, you know, pretty much. Genki had just gotten there. And there was a handful, maybe like 10 people who had been training with Webb for a while. My other teacher, the two, Genki and Webb, were the two teachers. Anyway, you know, it was just an astonishing experience because, you know, we were getting up at 4:30, which I don't believe I'd ever done in my life. And we were starting at 5 and we were going to bed at 10:30. And Genki had just come from Japan, so he gave the instruction that the standard length of sitting would be 45 minutes. And we have a 30-minute length, but he had 45, and it makes a huge difference. It was like, by the end of the first half day, everybody was wiped out. You know, so he changed it. He made it 30 minutes. But it was just extraordinary, right? I mean, I noticed somebody here who came for the first 2 days of our Sesshin. She has been wanting to come for a long time and finally came. And as she was going out, she had a look, her face looked totally different from when she came in. And, usually when people leave, their faces are beautiful. If they stay for the full 5 days, they go through this process. But about day two, everybody looks a little shell-shocked. And I noticed this person looked slightly like, what hit me, you know, what hit me? And that's how I must have looked at it too, because I was just totally wiped out. It was just by day two I could barely walk. It was just like, just sitting on the mat, just getting to the mat hurt so much, and I would just sit there in pain. And I remember going into Dokusan, sort of like crawling into Dokusan. And Genki just looked at me, and he was so sympathetic to my, and he said, you know, he really bucked me up, and it was really, I was just hurting. It was just so much pain. And then at night, it was interesting, you know, where we used to have Sesshin was a retreat center for the Baptists. They had a beautiful place. Up in the mountains, the director of the center really loved our group, but eventually their central religious authorities decided that they shouldn't be renting to Buddhists, so they asked us not to come anymore. But for about 5 years we used that place, and this director was a really lovely man. And and so, you know, we were in a big room, sort of like this, and the kitchen, there was a kitchen right off the room. There wasn't any dining hall like we have here. And there was no door, so when people were preparing food, they had to be very, very quiet. Most of the food was already prepared, and they would just heat it up. So we would be, about 25 people, we would hear people preparing dinner. And then at night, you could hear the rats. Rats would come into the kitchen, and they'd be squeaking. And I thought, oh my God, rats! You know, and Genki Roshi said something so interesting. You know, he actually talked about the rats in the Teisho, and he said in Japan, he said rats, anywhere rats live is considered a good place. It must be a pretty safe place, pretty healthy place to live. And so he said, naturally we're not going to hurt the rats in any way. We just make sure all the food is sealed up so they can't get at it. And I just thought, God, this guy is amazing. You know, I really love this person. You know, he told me once that when he was a boy, they had like a barn at the temple. He would come into the barn and he could see the rat tails hanging off one of the rafters in the barn. And he knew they were up there watching him. But was a very compassionate person. And so we had our sesshin, and at night we could hear the rats squeaking away. And yeah, there was nothing for them to eat, so they stopped coming. It was an extraordinary experience. I can remember just a few details. I can just remember mostly being in a lot of pain. And I can remember just a few details, you know, like sitting there listening to the rice cook. And I can remember hearing the rat squeak. And I also can remember one night going out to this, there was a big bathroom, and there was a big wash basin, a big circular basin where all these spigots came down from the ceiling in a big circle. Somebody must have invented this thinking this was a great idea, but instead of having lots of sinks, you just had one giant sink made out of zinc. And you turned on your taps and the water fell into the zinc sink, and there was like a big central drain. I turned the water on and just watched it bounce on the metal. And it was still dark. I was just washing my face. And it caught the light. There was an overhead bulb, and the water, wet metal, was shimmering, you know. It just was so deeply relaxing, you know. So anyway, after the sesshin, I made it through. I survived, and I don't know why, but I felt really good, and I couldn't have told you after all that pain why I would ever come back to another sesshin. Somebody at this sesshin had not sat with our group before. And on day two came into the Dokusan room, and I said, "How was your sitting?" And this person said, "I feel like I've come home." And that I realized in retrospect is how I felt about sesshin, like I had come home. I don't know what that means, but I felt like I was at home. And even though it was so challenging in so many ways, nothing else in my life did that for me. Even being home, right? It was this deep sense of connectedness. We used to also have a place after the Baptists asked us to leave. We found another place. We used to have to take a ferry in Seattle. Seattle's on the edge of big body of water, the Puget Sound, and there's a regular traffic, a ferry traffic. Huge numbers of people use the ferry to get across the sound, and we used to have to take a ferry out to it's called Hood Canal, out to the canal, and I was riding with a woman named Abby Terrace, and we were just talking, and she said, "You know." I didn't realize until I started doing Zen, but I was hungry all my life. And this is the first time I feel like that hunger is being satisfied. And I understood exactly what she meant. So, you know, there's something about Zen which I think is quite unique. You know, and it's taken me a long time to understand how it works. But basically, we have these two minds. We have this little discriminating mind, and this is where we live most of our lives. But then we have this other mind that is, you know, really extraordinarily. That this is the mind of connectedness, the mind of connectedness. And the little mind is, really, in some ways, a mind of separation. You know, the self is really, exists in separation from other things. And, you know, because it's separated, it always feels desire because it's separated, And it's always somewhat unsatisfying because it's separated. To have a self from the Buddhist standpoint is necessary and inevitable, but unsatisfactory because something is always missing. That's the very nature of selfhood. You know, so you could say a self is like a wave on the ocean, but it really, as it rises out of the ocean, it feels, sometimes it's a happy wave, and it says, this is really cool, and so on. But it always feels a little bit separate, because that's what it means to be a wave. Well, the self is separateness. That's what the self is, and that's what identity is. And it's important to develop a healthy identity. It's important to... Identity really depends very much on being separate from others and different from others. You know, I know so many people who have kids, who have two kids, and the kids have all kinds of identity anxieties about their siblings, you know. So, usually children, you know, if you have two boys, or you know, they won't do the same things. You know, they'll try to separate from each other in some important way. It can even be boy and girl like that. I have a friend of mine who is a scientist at Rutgers, and he was saying he has two daughters, and he said, my first daughter, he said, went to Rutgers and got straight A's, and she's going to graduate school in, you know, microbiology or something. And I said, how about your other daughter? And he said, oh, you know, her grades are terrible, she won't study, and, you know, I'm worried about her getting in trouble. And you can say, what's that all about? But it's really about identity, right? I mean, the other daughter is trying to be different from the first. The first daughter must be the one who gets all the compliments. You know, the mother and father must say, you should really be like Sally. You know, why can't you be more like Sally? This is like poison, right? Because nobody wants to be a knockoff of Sally. Nobody wants to be a second best Sally. You want to be, even if you're going to be a criminal, at least you'll be a better, you know, you'll be yourself, right? So, his daughter has had a lot of trouble finding an identity that lets herself be different from her older sister. And you see this in relations between father and son, or father and daughter, or mother. You know, people have to be different from their parents too. It can't be this exactly the same. This is what identity is all about, you know. And so, you know, it's important to develop a healthy identity. You know, it's important for this guy to have a second daughter who will find some way of being herself in an non-destructive way, in a healthy way. So, you know, maybe she won't be a scientist. Maybe she'll go into the arts or something. Hopefully, something like that, you know. And then she can have her own thing. She can be her own person. And you know, people worry. You know, they say, well, who am I? What am I? And what they mean is there something that will make me distinct and valuable in myself, in my separateness, right? And it's, you know, I like to think that I'm good at my job. I like to think that I'm probably irreplaceable in my job. I know I'm not, but I like to think I am. I like to think, boy, you know, I went to this meeting once, and a guy, a dean, said to me, you are going to be hard to replace, you know. And first of all, I thought, well, who wants to replace me? But then I thought, well, that's actually a compliment, right? You know, exactly, right? I'm hard to replace, you know. And I felt good about myself, right? Because, darn it, you know, it would be hard to replace me. Right? So this is good. I felt good. I walked home after I got over my initial paranoia about who wants to replace me. I felt better about myself, you know, which was good. And that's so human and necessary. You know, if you're a doctor, you want somebody to go, doctor, you're such a good doctor. Or if you're an artist, you want somebody to say, you're a genius, my God, you're a genius, you know, no, this painting, I can't get it out of my mind, you know. That's so important. It's not bad. It's good and it's necessary. We must develop a self that's satisfying and that has dignity and so on. But let's not kid ourselves. You know, that is based upon a kind of separateness. And it always involves a certain amount of, because it's always based on separateness, it always involves a certain amount of, unsatisfactoriness, right? I mean, you know, so many people, I have so many friends now who are about my age who have done really well in their life decisions, you know. So they are some distinguished scientists or they're scholars and they get, you know, they get there, you know, they get to the place where they're respected, but they feel very restless, you know, okay, I've done everything society wants me to do. I've published all these books. I've written 400 scientific articles, but my life feels empty somehow. This is very common. I mean, people who have very accomplished identities still can feel very empty, and it's a shock for them sometimes, right? To have been so successful and yet feel so empty. And of course, you know, it's a nice problem to have, right? It's a nice problem to be very accomplished at being a self and yet, you know, and then saying, what else is there? I know a lot of people who don't feel very accomplished. You know, I have a friend who is an artist, who is a really superb artist, and she's never been able to make a living as a painter and, you know, never really broke through into getting critical attention. And that's hard, you know, and she's an excellent painter, you know, so that's difficult. That's very difficult, you know. I mean, she's accomplished as an artist. She's an incredible artist, but she would like to be a more conventionally successful person. She'd like to have, you know, Art News magazine do a story on her, and that would be great for her. It may never happen, you know. So that's difficult. That's another way we find that the self is unsatisfactory. We realize, gee, you know, I feel like I missed the boat, or I feel like I haven't, you know, quite done it, you know. But either way, you know, whether we're very accomplished as a self or we feel that we haven't accomplished everything we needed, you know, people are going to come to a place where they feel there's a kind of emptiness about the whole thing. And Zen is about this other way of being. You know, there's this other aspect to ourselves which isn't, you know, the personal self aspect. It's a different we have this deeper life, which is really like common to everybody else. It's something we share. On a certain level, we're all different, but on a deeper level, we're all the same. We're all the same. And this is, you know, part of growing up and becoming a person is separating. But underneath all this separation, there's this ground of connectedness. You know, it's like one life. And this is unconsciously present all the time. It's the foundation for all of our existence. Is this, earlier in the session, I talked about the fact that we have these experiences early in our lives that are like the foundation of who we are, where, you know, you're a baby and you're crying, and somebody comes and picks you up. Or you know, you're fed when you're hungry, or you know, you're cold and somebody brings you a blanket, you know, and this builds up this relationship of trust, but also connectedness, right? This is more important in a way than individual selfhood, I think, because this is without this, everything is really goes, everything is lost, right? I mean, this is really essential. There's this under, that underneath the ice, that if consciousness is the tip of the iceberg, underneath is this big interconnected life. And so, you know, Zen is about how to experience the world in its interconnectedness, not in its separateness. And it means being able to tap into our unconscious mind. There's a personal unconscious, and that's very important, you know. But if you go down through the layers of the mind, there's an even deeper unconscious, which is this fundamental interconnected unconscious, you know. And so, you know, when we're doing our zazen practice and we are in deep samadhi, sometimes we experience things as connected to ourselves, you know. So you might be listening to the sound of insects and all of a sudden you feel totally unified with that sound, or you feel like the sounds are just passing through you and that you're a transparent medium, or you're an open door. And this sense of interpenetration or interbeing is fundamental to a healthy mental life and to social life, really. You know, you can't have a community without this, but you can't live at all without this trust and basic connectedness, you know. And people develop all kinds of illnesses, you know, spiritual and mental illnesses, when this trust is eroded or it's no longer accessible to people. So Zen is like going down to the under the surface, to the iceberg underneath the tip. Or to another way of putting it is that, you know, really from the Zen standpoint, individual people are like waves on an ocean. This is a common metaphor in Buddhism. You know, basically you are a wave on the ocean. And it's wonderful to enjoy yourself as wave, you know, as separate from the ocean. You know, but actually, at some point, it becomes a little unsatisfactory to be too separate. And when we return to the ocean, there's this deep sense of, just like that guy said, you know, I feel like I've come home. This deep sense of coming home. And so, you know, Zen is about learning how to actualize this other intelligence. And Mushin is especially important because that's the door into the unconscious. Many years ago, my second teacher, Webb, gave me a painting by the painter Seshu. And it was a reproduction, rather, of a painting. And I lost it, I'm sorry to say. Or actually, it was stolen. We had it on our altar at the University of Washington. And basically, it was on one of those pressed boards. It was a photo reproduction blown up, and then it was put on one of those, styrofoam boards. And it looked quite beautiful, and we would put it up on the altar. And then we would stash it in a closet at the University of Washington, and somebody stole it out of the closet. But it was a beautiful, beautiful picture of two people, and they are sitting at the mouth of a cave. And the cave goes into a mountain. And if you look in the cave, in the mouth of the cave, there's like a stairway going up the mountain. And they're sitting there talking, apparently. And there's this really cool stairway that goes up inside of a mountain. And this is sort of like, this is like a little story about, this is like a little image of Zen practice, you know. That we're going into the mountain. And climbing up the mountain, this is like actualizing the unconscious mind. So it's a different kind of knowing. And when you are practicing Mu, you know, Mu is like that opening into the mountain. It's like the cave that goes up the stairs. At first, when you go to Mu, it just seems blank and maybe even trivial. And nothing happens, and you just sit there for a long time. No. If you are doing Mu Koan and you feel that you're not being successful, please don't worry too much about that, because, you know, I myself did the Mu Koan for years. You know, and I would when I was doing the Mu Koan, I would hear all these people going into the Dokusan room going, Mu, Mu, you know. And they would scream, you know, it was like the pots were rattling and things like that, you know. And then I would just think, that's it, I'm going to do it, I'm going to pass the Mu Koan. And I would go in and I couldn't open my mouth. You know, I could not open my mouth. And I am not kidding you. I wanted to do it, but when I was there, I couldn't do it. And it was, you know, you can say, well, why not? You know, why not? And that's a deep psychological, I was practicing very profoundly, right? I mean, I was sitting in front of that blank cave, and I was there a lot. And then when I went in to call Mu, I didn't just go, oh, I'll make an impression, Moo. I really tried to reach deeply into myself and call Moo. But when I did that, I was frozen. And I really was frozen. I don't think I could have called Moo to save my life. And I was so frustrated. I remember going in at one session and Genki sort of going, come on, you know, go ahead, you can do it. And it's like, I could not do it, and I was so mad. I remember just being really furious. But I couldn't do it. It was like I knew on an unconscious level that door had not opened yet. And you know, when it did happen, when I finally did open the door, when the door finally opened, Basically, it was totally unexpected. As I said a few days ago, I wasn't expecting to answer the koan. It just happened, you know. And I just spent a lot of time with Mu, you know. The teacher, you know, tries to discern the character of your Mu, right? I mean, basically, the teacher is trying to discern the spontaneity of your calling Mu. So, there are people who are relatively shallow practitioners of Zen, you know, and they have no trouble coming in and screaming their head off, but that's really not what it's about. It's really reaching down into yourself and calling Mu. Everything hinges on that, you know. And you do meet people who, you know, just come in and scream their head off, but that's not what it's not. And by the way, there are people who give very, you know, who call Mu, oh, and that could be a wonderful answer, you know. So it's really about actually opening the door, touching the unconscious, and then once you have tapped into that, you know, you have to learn how to use it. You have to learn how to use it. Sometimes we learn how to use it automatically. You know, so for example, I was reading on the way home on the airplane from France. I was reading the In-Flight magazine, which is usually terribly boring propaganda, you know. But this was fascinating. It was about British, everybody was going to see the Olympics. And this was a British, I was on a British Airways plane, so there was an in-flight magazine that was talking about the Olympics of 1938. So this was, World War II was just, was it 38, 36? I guess it was 38. World War II was already on. And there were these British, and it talked about the British athletes training. And Britain was really broke. You know, they went down into complete disaster. The Germans wiped them out in France. And they had to borrow a bunch of money from the United States. Their army was completely destroyed at Dunkirk. And they had no money. They had they were still in the Depression. And they were interviewing these athletes, and there was this one guy who was a boxer. And he said, I only got one meal a day. He was taking care. He was the only guy in his family of eight who had a job. And he said, I worked from dawn till dusk, and I trained for the Olympics in my spare time. And he said, I only got one meal a day. And he said, the way I kept myself going was I would have bread with jelly on it. He said, that was my little extra, because they could get some jelly, And he said, I never had enough to eat, but when I was training, I would have jam and bread, It was just like, wow. So then he had to fight, I can't remember the champion he fought, but he said that, he didn't expect to win. He just wanted to do an honorable showing. And he said this guy, his opponent was, I think, Australian or something. He was really an amateur champion of the world or something. And he said, I thought I was training and I was going in to fight with this guy. And he said, all I can remember is, putting on my gloves, and I said to my trainer, when do we go in? And the guy said, what are you talking about? The fight's over. And I'm not kidding. The only thing he can remember of the whole fight is, he put on his gloves, and he said to his trainer, when do we go in? And the trainer said, what are you talking about? The fight is over. And he had won. He was a world heavyweight champion. Isn't that amazing? But you read about stuff like that. The big mind just took over. Athletes talk about this all the time. I remember reading a runner who said, basically what happens is I get down in the crouch position and the next thing I know the race is over. And it's all big mind the whole time. But we have this big mind, this extraordinary intelligence that is always under the surface of the other intelligence, the discriminating intelligence. And we feel lonely and insecure because we can't access that. But when we can, it's like the two halves come together. It's like the two halves that fit together. In Chinese Buddhism, there's a beautiful poem called it's called The Song of the Matching Halves. And it's like yin and yang, yin and yang. They're each inadequate without the other. So consciousness and unconsciousness are need to be together in functioning in unity. And when they are, the human being is whole. You feel like you're at home. And when they aren't, you might be very intelligent, but you feel alienated and you're crippled by chronic self-doubt, which is really a kind of distrust of the universe. So Zen practice is like opening the door to the big mind, going up the mountain through that cave, and then, being able to unify that with your everyday life. And that's a fully actualized, fully functional human being. And that's the goal of Zen. So, today, is day five of our wonderful sesshin, where we're all learning how to more fully enter into that big mind. And it's quite beautiful. It's really magical to be able to experience that connectedness. And the joy that comes from that connectedness. And if you haven't felt it today, please just hang in there. It's not easy, right, to get through our obstacles. It's difficult, And depending on our obstacles, it can take, sometimes people have been hurt or injured in ways that take a long time to work through. But, the very effort to be better, it shows that there is a deeper intelligence at work. The very desire to be healthy is a sign that there's a healthier mind under the surface. Our big mind is helping us day and night to wake up. It wants us to be happy. It wants us to be healthy, safe, connected. And we get very confused. Hakuin, the great Japanese Zen master Hakuin, said, we're like a person who is up to his neck in water complaining about thirst. And what he means is that when we're in consciousness, when we're trapped in consciousness, there are these crippling doubts, right? Crippling sense of separation and so on. But right under the surface of the mind is this great unity, right? This unconscious unity. So learning how to access that is like life-saving technique, right? So, we have a few more precious hours. We have one more Dokusan. Hoen of Tozon said, even Shakyamuni, even the Buddha and Maitreya, the Buddha to come, are servants of another. I want to ask you, who is he? He means servants of this big mind, this deep unconscious mind. Please encounter it yourself. Mumon's comment, if you can really see this another with perfect clarity, it is like encountering your own father at a crossroads. Why should you ask whether you recognize him or not? Mumon's verse, don't draw another's bow, don't ride another's horse, don't discuss another's faults, don't explore another's affairs. In other words, as long as we are in the small mind, we're always second-guessing ourselves. We're always imagining, we say, well, what would Bill do? What would Bob do? I just don't know if I should do this. What would Susan do? What will people think of me if I do this? What do people say if I do this? This is the small mind's prison. So this is drawing another's bow, see, riding another's horse, always looking to others for ratification. And we all do it, but it's neurotic, right? So if we can get in touch with our, we say in Zen, our true nature. You know when something feels right. You know when something feels right. Trust that. We don't trust that. But Sesshin was the most difficult thing I'd ever done, but it felt so right. And even though it almost killed me, it felt so right. So Zen is learning how to trust that. Learning how to trust that.